this week on the Backtable Podcast.
I think there's plenty of IR docs out there, obviously, as the vascular space for IR has kind of come back, I think, over the last 5 to 8 years. There's plenty of people now in the space and have the patients and are doing clinic, right? I mean, clinic's still, I think, sometimes a scary word for IR doctors, even though it shouldn't be. And putting out there and being a clinician. And I think it's just a lot easier transition and procedure than what's perceived, right? I think anything with the spine kind of freaks people out. I mean, if you're able to do a kyphoplasty and all those type of things, you're going to be fine.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. First, a brief message from our sponsor.
Do you have patients on gabapentin or pregabalin still suffering from pain associated with diabetic neuropathy? They might benefit from Nevro 10 kHz therapy. In a large randomized controlled trial, 90% of patients experienced substantial long-term pain relief, and 65% of patients experienced sensory improvements. Nevro's proprietary 10 kHz therapy is the only paresthesia-independent spinal cord stimulator, which means patients don't have to feel dysesthesias to get relief. If you have patients suffering from painful diabetic neuropathy after conventional treatment, recommend Nevro 10 kHz therapy. It's the most effective treatment for refractory painful diabetic neuropathy. Learn more at hfx4pdn.com/healthcare-providers. Now, back to the show.
All right, this is Dana Dunleavy back from Buffalo, New York. Lucky to be here with Blake Parsons, who is more frequently on the show than I am, quite a few episodes, being a fantastic guest. And in this one, we're being a little bit odd in talking about PAD, CLI, and also the implications of diabetic neuropathy, and how we as interventional radiologists can contribute to that. Blake, I know you've spoken about your practice before, but any updates and how everything is going?
No, essentially we're just growing, I think, from our last update we had. You know, we have been kind of doing annual reimbursement updates, which I think we need to do for 2024 anyway as well. But slowly growing, I think we now have 3 vascular surgeons, 5 interventional cardiologists, and then I'm still the Lone Ranger IR doctor in the practice, so staying strong, just me still so far.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, you know, you've had a bunch of episodes predominantly talking about reimbursement and making sure that the rest of us are educated, you know, both in terms of interventional cardiology, vascular surgery, interventional radiology, but also, you know, procedures like prostate artery embolization. And so that's been fantastic. Are you predominantly in OBL or ASC, or is it a pretty even split?
Well, so we have a hybrid model, which we've talked a little bit about. So it's both an OBL and an ASC. It's the same facility, same surgical rooms, same angiography rooms. It's just based on the 24 hours it's open, its designation. So, but to answer your question, as we've discussed in reimbursement, as reimbursement has changed, we're definitely doing a lot more, even what we would consider IR procedures in the ASC space, because even a lot of the embolization, especially for arterial and venous, is transitioning to the ASC. End organ embolization, so your prostates and fibroids, they're still staying strong in the OBL space. Now, that can also be, as you negotiate insurance contracts, it may behoove you to have them push that into the ASC space as well. But yeah, I think it's kind of as we saw a couple of years ago, it is slowly moving into the ASC space. The PAD part has moved obviously much faster than the IR specific, but it is moving that way.
And you guys have addressed before, you know, kind of the 12% cut in OBLs for predominantly PAD work, and that some of that has actually had a slight bump or increase in the ASC. Does that still seem to be relevant for 24?
Yeah, we've, over the last, our projection models have just kind of shown an increased growth over the year-over-year of hopefully around like 3% is kind of what we're looking at. But still, there's been a drop in the OBL space and the PAD. I mean, you're still, it's profitable to do it in the OBL space. Don't get me wrong, but there's definitely been a changeover in reimbursement for Medicare. Yeah.
No, I appreciate you guys giving the updates and helping everyone to, I think, start thinking about their sites of service and where they need to be to provide great care. You know, you've also demonstrated the cost reductions to the system in providing outpatient care. And that's really been fantastic too. And in that, you know, we talked with Doug Beal in the past, you know, and most of things interventional spine tend to live on the MSK podcast. But really, we realized there's a huge gap and need to talk, you know, about our foundation as vascular interventional radiologists. And all of your talks and episodes have been really on the vascular side. So what are you doing here now?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of funny how we got started, which, by the way, I know Doug Beal very well. He's here in my hometown. I've probably known him now for about 15 years. Fantastic doc, and obviously a great person. So I rotated with him, man, back when I was an intern, I think, a long time ago. And honestly, that's what got me interested in the outpatient model, because he's had an outpatient-based practice for a long time. But to bring back, so spinal cord stimulation, how did I get started? Honestly, you know, where I trained at Medical College of Wisconsin, we had a little bit of a unique service in that we spent a month on palliative care. And, you know, obviously there's a huge interventional oncology aspect to interventional radiology. So we were able to do a lot of the blocks and those type of pain interventions on a lot of those pain patients. So I'd already kind of had a little bit of a base of that. And so when I got out, I was probably in practice maybe a year, and I had some pain management docs reach out to me where they were doing trials in their office, but they didn't want to do the perms because they didn't have ownership at an ASC and it didn't behoove them to go to a hospital. So there wasn't really worth their time for the reimbursement. And they said, well, do you want to do the perms for me? And I said, okay, sure. So I probably started doing really perms out the gate before I even did trials. And that was probably about 5 to 6 years ago now. And so that's how I first kind of got into it and got exposed to the space.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that's the opposite, right, of most people that think, yeah, I guess maybe I could pull off a trial, but a perm sounds so scary. Can you take it down to, you know, what a perm means to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, this space and getting epidural access is, I mean, for interventional radiologists, this isn't a hard task, right? I mean, where you're quote-unquote, I guess, needle specialists, we're supposed to be good with our hands and be able to feel what tissue planes the needle's going through and all these things. So being able to get access into the epidural space is really not that challenging. And that's the most challenging part of the whole procedure. The permanent part of it, it's essentially just a glorified infusion port, right? You're just making a larger pocket and you're doing it in the supragluteal region on whichever side the patient wants. You do have to make a little incision at the access point at the lumbar spine where you're going to stick the needles, because you got to be able to place the leads, you know, tunnel them completely under the skin. So I think that's probably the biggest scare, is that incision, and that you've actually got to kind of feel like a real surgeon and do a little bit of cautery and cut down and work your way down to the interspinous ligament. And believe me, when you're doing, I think my first one was a very high BMI lady that I don't know why I took as my first one. And when you're about hand deep in their back and you're wondering where the heck the aorta is, because you've got to be getting close, you know, it can be a little nerve wracking. But there's nothing back there, right? It's just subcutaneous fat. Their paraspinous musculature is back there, but you'll know when you get to it. So it's really, I think, more scary, and because it's not part of our initial training. And so you think of it as like, oh, this is outside of my realm. But when you think of the vast amount of different things that we do as IR doctors, it's really not a challenging procedure, something that's just way out of your expertise.
It's a great point. And, you know, sometimes we hear from our colleagues and other specialties that will talk about either a trial or a permanent spinal cord stimulator taking them a lot of time. And what they mean by that is they just couldn't get the needle in the epidural space. For us, really, that's pretty effortless, you know, and whether that is you know, our gift, or just that we have good imaging. You know, I think either way, it's not that challenging. How do you look at it, you know, just sticking with the perms for a second, you know, to compare that to a Metaport? I mean, unlike Doug, you're kind of a standard interventional radiologist that did a body interventional fellowship, and you've spoken about interventional oncology before. You know, I look at jugular access, tunneling, pocket, and here it's epidural access, tunneling, pocket.
Yeah, and you're not even accessing a blood vessel. So, I mean, obviously the epidural space is scary to people because I think the big concern is, okay, well, what if I poke into the thecal sac? Well, we get into the thecal sac all the time to be able to do samples. Now you're using a much larger needle than what a 22 gauge, obviously. But that being said, your risk is still low. I mean, a spinal headache. But I think the other is people are always concerned, are they going to cause a nerve injury? Could you potentially cause like a bleed down there that could, you know, impinge the cord or cause some kind of neurologic effects? I will tell you that the risk is low. And to your point with the skill set and being able to use image guiding to our advantage, which is basically our whole specialty, it really is a much simpler procedure than what most people make it out to be. The permanent spinal cord stimulator pocket's about 3 to 4 times bigger than what you would make a port pocket. And again, it's just in the subcutaneous tissue. The hardest part of the deal is for us is probably just sewing the pocket up at the end, just because it takes us a little longer because, you know, we're not spending all day like my vascular surgery partners sewing all day long. So I, of course, I get harassed and made fun of from the windows about my sewing skills, but we get through it. I tell them it looks better than theirs, so that's all that matters to the patient.
Yeah, and so, you know, for a lot of our colleagues, they may wonder about site of service, RVUs, reimbursement. It seems to be, even though I would say that we're all focused on efficacy, a lot of people are feeling more RVU pressures now. Have you ever looked at RVUs of Metaport versus spinal cord stimulator?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers, but it's going to be a big, big multiple on the spinal cord stimulator versus the Metaport. Like, for instance, putting in a port somewhere around $2,000 to $3,000 probably in a outpatient setting, not at the hospital. At the hospital, you're going to get paid, obviously, hospital rates. But, you know, a spinal cord stimulator, a trial, and now we can get kind of into that as well. There's a big difference even on the trial or on the spinal cord stimulator on the trial side from doing it in your office versus doing it in a surgery center. Most pain guys do them in their office because they're there, it's fast, they put them down. Now they're going to get paid about $700 to do it in their office. A leads, you know, they're out a couple hundred bucks for 2 leads. So for the time it takes them, it's decent revenue. If you do that same trial in an ambulatory surgery space, you're looking at more around like $9,000, even a little more depending on what state you're in. So there's a much bigger margin, obviously, in the ASC. Now, to do the permanent, it has to be placed in a surgery center. You cannot do a permanent implant in an OBL setting. And that also, it's going to vary based on your volume and what you're getting your generator pricing at, but you can roughly figure it's going to be also somewhere around of a margin to around $10,000. So, you know, if you're doing a trial and a permanent, and you're doing them both in a surgery center for, you know, a commercial paid patient, you're looking at around $20,000 of profit. That's after costs. So,
right. And to your point, you know, the trial is practically free, right? I mean, it's one of the lowest cost procedures that we do from supply standpoint. You know, going back on that, you know, one of your prior episodes, you were talking about prostate artery embolization and that, you know, when we're all getting started, it can seem like it might not be the best utilization of our time. One of the things people talk about with trials is that, you know, just very simple and predictable procedure. Thoughts on kind of the time utilization?
Yeah, I think doing a spinal cord stimulator trial, now obviously there's a little bit of difference if they've had extensive back surgery history, you can run into some more tricky because they get scar tissue in the epidural space. But a patient who's basically got a virgin back, so to speak, and you're going to do a trial on them, yeah, it's a, we'll say in and out 25 minutes. That's prep time, get them on the table and everything. You know, it's a 10 minute, but all you're doing is you're getting fluoroscopic guided imaging into the epidural space. You're going to run a lead up to this place, depending on where their area of coverage you're trying to get. You're going to then access it again with another needle, which the second one always seems easier because you've already kind of tented the epidural space and it's ready to go. You can do that kind of in a side-by-side fashion on the same side, or you can do it where you have access from both left and right sides into the epidural space. It doesn't really matter either way, whatever you're comfortable with. But then once you put those leads in, you're done. I mean, they know you tape it to their back and they hook the leads to the generator, which all gets taped to the patient's back for the trial. And that's about it. And the patient, obviously, the beauty of these procedures too is versus all the other things we do is the rep doesn't just show up and hand you your stuff and leave. This rep is now married to this patient, right? So the patient's continuously getting checked on by the rep every day. They're updating you. They're dealing with all of their programming and everything like that. I do zero programming. So when these patients come in to see me for follow-ups, the rep is in the clinic with me. They know when my patients are in for and scheduled, and they are the ones managing the stimulation part. Obviously, I'm still speaking with the patients and making sure they're doing okay and all of that. But so that's another kind of bonus procedure as well. From a timeline standpoint, just to kind of enter it now, the perm, I'd say add another 30 minutes or so at least. It's probably an hour to do a permanent placement, especially in the beginning, just because you do have to sew the pocket. It's going to be a multi-layer sewing or closure, especially in the back part probably. So until you get quicker at it and all that, it's going to run you a little bit. But still an hour case. I mean, that's pretty typical for any IR case.
Yeah, and you know, just one thing on the reimbursement. I think that, you know, your numbers all sound good, except many places in the OBL probably have about, you know, 3,000-4,000 you know, for their OBL reimbursement for a trial. And as you know, the supplies aren't much. So for many interventional pain docs, as you noted, they're pretty happy just doing trials and not even bothering with perms. But it's nice that you're able to do it all. And, you know, just getting into, you know, I think a lot of our colleagues have asked, you know, just can you explain a little bit about the technique, you know, how the patient's positioned, kind of what type of access, you know, your angulation and what level you're starting at?
Sure. So, you know, all of mine are essentially for leg, low back and leg pain coverage. I don't do any cervical spinal cord stimulation. Not to say I couldn't, it's just not part of my practice, which we can get into a little bit. But so, yeah, so the patient's going to come in. They're obviously going to be prone. Me, since I'm obviously with a bunch of surgeons, they, always want to be extra cautious in their nature when anytime a patient's prone. So when we do ours in the ASC, we actually have anesthesia for both the trial and the permanent. Now they're giving them a MAC. It's just propofol and, you know, whatever. We're not tubing the patients, but we do have that. Whereas most pain guys, especially in their clinic, they're just doing them without that in their office. So it's just user preference. We pack kind of multiple pillows underneath their belly because we want to have a little bit of a forward flex. And so that way to open up the spinous processes as well, the space. Access for me is most typically anywhere from L2, L3 to T12, L1. It just kind of depends on the patient. Do they have prior spinal hardware, all that? And then I typically, it really kind of depends. If now, when I first started, I would do an access from the left and the right at kind of an angle into the and paramedian approach. And the biggest thing is you don't want to come in too steep. If you try to just come straight down like you're doing, trying to get into thecal space for an aspiration, it's going to be way too hard to be able to curve that needle up into the epidural space. So you really kind of almost want to come in like a 45. It's really very similar to getting arterial access in a femoral artery, to be honest with you. It's a very similar angulation and approach into the epidural space. So the trial, there's no incision or anything. You're going to take the spinal needle, which has got a little bevel on the end for protection. I first obviously numb the skin. I use both bupivacaine and lidocaine just to give them a little extra. I'll put a 22 gauge spinal in just to get a little deeper to give them some numbing relief. And then I'll use the access needle to get in. Once you will feel essentially a pop into the epidural space. How I've kind of changed my practice a little bit and looking is I get down, you'll most inevitably hit either the spinous process or, you know, some type of bone around. So you know you're close, right? And then I'll kind of pull back and find where I'm at. I then now, which you don't have to do, I'll have my I'll go lateral on my view. And that way I know exactly where the epidural space is. And I just start slowly advancing my needle under fluoro. And once I feel that pop and I know it's right there at the epidural space, I know I'm there. I use a loss of resistance syringe. So it's just a little syringe that has a little bit of air that you put in it. If as long as you can just barely touch it and that air slides in, you know you're in the epidural space. You're obviously not getting any CSF fluid back, knowing that you're in the thecal sac. If that air doesn't go in, you know you haven't gotten in there yet. And then once I've verified, you can also use contrast if you prefer that instead. But once I've verified I'm in the epidural space, then you're going to just slide the lead and it'll slide in. As soon as it starts to slide in, I'll go back AP. And then obviously you want to verify that it's staying midline. It can start to shoot off to the side and get in what we call like the gutter. So it'll kind of go off into the side of the cord. So you're basically trying to get both of these leads just dead center in the middle of the back, right under the spinous process, side by side, and run them up. For back and leg coverage, you're ultimately trying to get the top of the lead up to T8, T12 area. If you're trying to get more coverage, you can actually stagger the leads, which obviously your reps will get into with you as well. So try to promote a longer coverage. So people not only have severe, say, peripheral diabetic neuropathy, and they also have chronic low back pain, you can essentially give them coverage for both of those, which they're obviously very happy about.
That was fantastic. And I think, one of the things you're addressing is that we are beyond kind of the old days of trying to do paresthesia type mapping. And so to your point, you know, your focus really is on vascular disease, diabetic neuropathy, lower extremity pain, kind of chronic gnawing neuropathy. And so to your point, just to kind of reiterate that, you're just driving the leads up where they need to be and just place them in the right location.
Yeah, most of the companies now don't. When I first started 5 years ago, a couple of the companies I used, they would want you to wake the patient up and let's do paresthesia and make sure we're getting coverage. Now, most of the companies don't. They just tell you, hey, we put it in the right location. Let's do the trial. Let's see how they do. There's multiple contact points on the lead. So when the patient gets out, you know, they have a little cell phone that it's hooked to and the rep is able to use it as well. They can actually, they're changing where the, what's going on, which contacts are going. So they're moving it up and down the spine so they can figure out at what area they're getting the best coverage, as well as they're tweaking different variables of the stem. But to your point, yes. So now it's even shorter because now you just put the lead in and you're done. You don't have to wake the patient up, give them stem, make sure they're getting coverage into their toes, you know, then and finish up.
And to your point earlier, essentially you tape, you know, the battery on the side of the patient, they leave and the rep talks to them every day for, what do you prefer? 5, 6, 7 days?
Yeah, you have to do at least 5 days for insurance purposes, but I typically do 5 to 7. It really depends on the patient. Some patients by day 5 they're miserable, not because of the stimulation, but their back gets sore. They haven't showered, so they can't shower. They can't bathe. They're sponge bathing, right? Because you can't have something half in and half out of the body, even though we've covered it all up, the risk of infection, right? So they're pretty miserable by that time, and they're torn. They usually love the relief they're getting, but at the same time, they're ready to be able to take a shower. So I usually do 5 to 7 days.
Okay. Fantastic. And people sometimes worry, what's this process for removing the leads?
It's really super easy. So say they come back in 7 days, they're at my clinic and they're there for a lead pull. The rep is there with me. They're usually already been in the room talking to the patient for a while, working, making sure they were getting, because they've been adjusting the stimulation basically every day. They're trying new programs, different, you know, amplitudes, whatever, kilohertz. They're trying different things to be able to make sure they're getting optimum stimulation and coverage. So they've already done that. I walk in and then it's me obviously talking, making sure that the patient is, we're checking what is their percentage of improvement, right? Like you want to at least achieve a 50% improvement in their pain, or else it's not, A, it won't get covered to move forward, but B, we don't want to implant things in patients that they're not getting adequate coverage and they're happy with, you know, with their improvement. So obviously going through all that with the patient. And then the lead pull is essentially, I just take the tape off and the two leads slide right out. They're not anchored. There's nothing holding them in there. So the leads just slide out. That's kind of part two. Like after you've done a trial, you know, that's a little bit of it if they get great coverage. And then towards the end of the trial, let's say that they're like, man, I'm not getting as good a coverage as I was before. There is a little bit of risk of having lead migration, right? So these patients are rolling around in bed and they're moving around and doing their things, even though what we essentially tell them is act like you got a midriff shirt on and it's tucked in and you don't want it to become untucked, right? But it's tough, especially performing daily activities for a week. So they can move. They're pretty easy to pull out. It's painless. We just pull them out right there in the clinic. Now remember, the leads are going to come out regardless if they like it or not, right? We've got to take it out. And if they decide they want to move on to the permanent, then that gets scheduled and at a later date.
And are you working on authorization prior to the trial, or, you know, some practices don't really deal with perm auth until after? Which way do you guys approach it?
Yeah, so we submit the perm as soon as we've done the trial. So because we resubmit, obviously their pain improvement and all that is going to have to be known for the permanent placement. So all that gets submitted once we see them for their post-trial follow-up.
And are you already doing things like psych eval prior to the trial?
So that's exactly right. So they'll want you to have a psych eval in there. So we have, you know, 5 years ago, it was a lot harder here in Oklahoma. They actually had to go and see a psychologist, psychiatrist, and get our piece of paper that said they weren't crazy. And that was hard because there was a little bit of, hey, I'm going to get the guys that send me a lot more patients in faster than I am not. And so, but now times have changed and most people now have where they just do it telehealth. So we set them up. We have a couple different options. So they, it's all over the phone. They fill out a little test form or go over it with the physician. And then we get a piece of paper back, which is ultimately what's needed for insurance, saying that we can, that essentially they're doing it to make sure that is their pain truly real, that there's not something else underlying psychosocial going on, which is contributing to their pain, and that their pain's actually due to whatever the ailment is that you're seeing them for. So they want that as part of their packet for approval.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, when I, you were noting at the beginning, you traveled to some rural areas that are a bit underserved. When I entered into one of those underserved areas, I talked to one of the interventional pain docs and said, you know, who can I send these patients to for psych eval? And they said, there's no one here. And basically they, you know, as you said, now there are a lot of resources for these patients as part of the process, you know, to do it from home, which is really nice.
Yeah. Essentially, when I see them, we've talked about it, they want to move forward with a trial. I hand them the paper there in clinic, so they already fill it out, and then they'll get contacted within a week by the physician. So it's a pretty easy process now.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, there's optional auth support too, kind of the same as that. Yeah. Do you utilize that?
Yes, we do. So pretty much every company will have their own team. So auths for stem and trial and perm, they can, depending on the insurance company, it can be, well, I should say the indication. So if you're, you know, peripheral neuropathy is going to be an easier indication to meet and what they've had to have done slash failed and conservative side versus say someone that came to you for back pain. Okay. They're going to have undergone a lot more workup for a back pain patient. And so you're going to have all that, you know, all your T's crossed and I's dotted when you submit that. So these teams with these different companies, that's what they're there for. So they take our notes, they go through all of our stuff. So if you do get a denial, they're the ones that will fight it for you and make sure that they see everything, they get it all proven, and they help. So it's just adding manpower essentially for you that are their employee FTEs that you're not going to have to hire that are essentially specialists in this part to be able to get these approved. So it's an added bonus that these companies will help you. Plus they have all the data. All these people are efficient with it. They know how to go back at the insurance companies and help fight these claims.
And you mentioned at the beginning, but you know, you're a vascular specialist. You know, you're not really looking for patients with failed back surgery. And, you know, one of the wonderful things I think we've found, right, is that, you know, failed back, depending on the study we look at, responder rate about 60-70%. Painful diabetic neuropathy, really looking at a responder rate of over 90%. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's been great. And maybe I'll start with a little bit of like, how the heck did we get here, meaning me in this practice? So to your point, a large part of my practice is vascular. So both PAD and venous. Like I said earlier, I have three vascular surgeons. So we have a really big, and we have five cardiologists, and they don't do any PAD. They're cardiology only. So we have a large vascular practice and a large amount of patients that come through our clinic. So these patients, we have them, right? They're vasculopaths. These are all patients who have diabetes. They're coming to us. And so what we would see is, me and my partners, is we're seeing these patients and yeah, we're working them up for their claudication or whatever else. But their biggest complaint was always their peripheral neuropathy. My feet are numb. They're on fire. I've got burning pins, needles. I can't walk. I feel unstable. I can't feel my feet, you know? And so, you know, we kind of eventually were like, well, what all is out there? Like what's, they act like there's no options essentially for them other than take gabapentin or Lyrica. And if that doesn't work, see you later. And so that's kind of how we started looking at the space. And then since I'd already done these permanent stems for back pain patients for another couple of guys, it was kind of an easy transition as we started to look into it. And then all the recent data that's come out recently, specifically for diabetic neuropathy, it just kind of made sense. So we actually started a neuropathy clinic at our facility, and it's run by one of our nurse practitioners. So I just work them up myself because I'm doing it. I'm used to what needs to be in the note and everything. But for all my partners, they will send these patients to our neuropathy clinic. And so then that way, the patients make sure that they're optimized. You know, they've tried all the medications. We're trying your gabapentin, your Lyrica, your amitriptyline, you know, duloxetine, whatever it is. They've done capsaicin patches, you know, whatever. Insurance requires that they have at least failed two conservative therapies, and that's all that they have. So there's not like back pain where they need to have done, you know, epidural injections, physical therapy, surgical consults, MRIs, all these different things that they have to go through from a back pain standpoint. You don't have to do that with peripheral neuropathy. So that makes it a lot easier. And obviously, not every peripheral neuropathy patient we see is going to need a spinal cord stimulator, right? Like every patient will tell you that they've got 10 out of 10 neuropathic pain. You say, oh, okay, well, there's this option. As soon as you tell them, some of them, about spinal cord stimulator, they're like, you know what? It's not too bad. So you find out real quick who's really in significant pain and who's not. And there's some people, they do fantastic on gabapentin or Lyrica or whatever the medication is, or they get significant enough relief that they're happy with the results and their activities of daily living is much improved and they just go on with that. But we've now streamlined the process so that if these patients do fail, we already have everything that we need to submit and move forward. And so it's essentially been, we're just capturing all these patients that we already had coming through the clinic. So we don't even do any, really, we don't even do any advertisement at all, which I'm sure that most places out there, just like the state of Oklahoma, where these neuropathy clinics have popped up everywhere that are primarily neurology owned. And so they do a lot. There's lots of advertising, lots of patients going through those as well.
A lot of great things you just mentioned, but you know, one is the neuropathy clinic. That's pretty cool. You know, one of the discussions, you know, if we think about your group of kind of OEIS people, right? You have cardiologists, vascular surgeons, interventional radiologists. The initial, I think, concern with this is, yeah, I see a tremendous amount of diabetic neuropathy in my clinic. You know, but that sounds pretty difficult to manage medications. So, I mean, to your point, you kind of have a basic sheet of what these classes are. Sounds like you have your go-to of your two classes.
Yeah. And then we'll trial different things too. Like I said, there's all kinds of stuff besides if they fail Lyrica. So Lyrica, you have to write as a scheduled, which is goofy, but it is what it is. And then, you know, we usually start everyone on gabapentin. There's obviously a high rate of, not complications, but side effects with gabapentin, most commonly being sleepy, tired. Some people, you really have to watch it in older people and what you're giving. I don't ever start them off with more than 100 milligrams at night. And even most of the time, it's hard for them to tolerate that. And then try Lyrica, but amitriptyline, those are other options. A lot of the SNRIs that are out there, you can try as well. So there's different drugs, but like I said, you technically only have to try two, and most of them will tell you they're tired of taking pills and they don't like the side effects from them. And what else can we do?
Yeah. For me, it's usually, you know, I have to go back in time with these patients, right? And just see what they've already discontinued. because most of them have already tried multiple classes.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty. I mean, to be honest, most of the time, by the time they see us, they've already tried more than two drugs, you know, so it's just the people who haven't had anything because there's, and we've got a lot of rural America out here. And so a lot of them don't have access to a lot of healthcare, haven't been undergoing a lot of management, or they're just, you know, good old boy farmer out there. They don't want to go to the doctor ever, but so they've come to you and they haven't had much of any kind of workup. But to your point, a large portion of them have already undergone medical management and failed it.
And, you know, some of the interventional radiologists have wondered, you know, how do you communicate with vascular surgeons, you know, about this, since, you know, probably the predominant, you know, vascular patients across the country are still with them. You know, my experience has been, you just tell them that they can refer the patient. They don't have to do any management. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm in a little bit of a unique situation because they're my partners. But for people that are in a IR-specific group, and obviously, there's probably a little bit of conflict between other vascular surgery groups. It's just about them having a TRUFS level too. I mean, their biggest, what I could see them having the biggest problem is, hey, if I refer you this patient, am I going to get the patient back? You know, and for fault, because inevitably they probably got underlying peripheral arterial disease that they're following as well, right? So that's just going to be, have to be a relationship that you build with that group and see if that is something that works. You know, it's, I think that's kind of the beauty of our group that we've been able to do. And a lot of the now kind of groups that we've been a part of around the country is trying to have a true multiple disciplinary approach where you've got multiple subspecialties together to try to work together and not necessarily kind of compete, you know, with each other.
And again, with your neuropathy clinic, you know, I think that's pretty common in our specialty to say, hey, you know, we have like a vein night, right, where people can come in for free. Or maybe you just have so many patients that it's just a clinic. Have you found that this has worked out well, offering a neuropathy clinic?
Yeah. So when we first started, you know, it was like an explosion because, you know, for people that have had practices going for, you know, say, you know, there's plenty of outpatient vascular practices out there that have been going on for a long time. Well, you now have a large volume of patients. Well, within an EMR system now, you can essentially go in and screen every patient that's on gabapentin, Lyrica, amitriptyline, whatever, and it's going to bring you up a giant list. So you now have just flagged essentially every neuropathy patient in your clinic. So now every time that patient comes in or you send them an email or a mailer or text or whatever, you can now say, hey, you know, how's your neuropathy? Okay, you know, it's not under control and it's really bothering you, then we've started a neuropathy clinic. If you would be happy to be involved with that, we can set you up. So that was a really basically just went from, you know, 0 to 60 right out the gate because we just all had this huge influx of patients. And then now, since that's been going on for several years, we still luckily have such a influx of new patients all the time that we're able to be there. And now since we've been doing it, you know, word kind of gets around and from our referring physicians as well. And so they've obviously been trying to manage these patients, even podiatrists that are managing them. And they can't get anywhere, then now they're starting to send them to us specifically for the evaluation for spinal cord stim.
And, you know, with that and some of the referrals you're getting from the community, can you speak at all to American Diabetes Association or endocrinology recommendations?
Yeah, so they've both been, over the last year, or maybe 2 years, I think, they've all been forward on saying that this is a valid option, especially given the new data that came out, you know, over the last year about the 10 kilohertz data and showing the significant improvement, not only in patient satisfaction and decrease in their pain levels, but there's even a lot of data, like there's a paper out by Chen showing, now it's a very small subsample showing that there's increase in fiber, nerve fiber density when they do punch biopsies. So now there's a big look at that as to why is that, you know, are we actually improving their sensation by increasing their nerve density touch? So, you know, filament tests on these patients have been shown that significant improvement in their numbness in their feet, which we can go on and on about. Not only are you improving their pain, but the other beauty, and I'm sure we can get more into of this whole procedure, is how else are we improving their quality of life and risk factors, right? So all these patients are, for the most part, not all, but most patients are diabetic. So, you know, they can't feel their feet. They're unsteady. They're older patients. They're complaining all the time about balance issues. Well, after they've done the trial or the perm, that's almost one of the top things they'll tell me is, oh my gosh, I can like walk out of my house on my yard and I can like feel the grass and I don't feel unsteady. I can walk. So, you know, at what percentage are we potentially saving these people from fall risk and broken hips and these type of things? On the other hand, on the flip side, from the PAD and vascular standpoint, if they now have better improvement in their sensory and their feet, how much are we now decreasing the risk of diabetic foot wounds because, you know, they're trimming their toenails and now they can actually feel the tip of their toes, or they're not scuffing their foot on the ground when they're walking, or their grandkid throws a Lego in their shoe and they can actually feel it instead of walking around on it. So these are all kind of the, I think, the future things that we've got to tease out that are really neat in the space about actually improving the quality of life more than just pain, you know?
Yeah. And to your point, right, everything you just spoke about is already evaluated in 6-month, 12-month, 24-month randomized controlled trials. You know, I think we were all shocked by how great the symptomatic improvement was, but kind of more impressed with the improvement in dysesthesias. Can you explain a little bit, you know, how do you assess that? Do you assess that in your practice at all?
Yeah, so we do filament testing before and after, and that's primarily what we do. Other than that, you know, a lot of these patients also have had other workups, be that be from neurology and those types. So a lot of them have even had, some of them had EMGs and those type of things as well. We don't repeat any of that post, but filament testing would be the one that we do the most.
Okay. And have you found that the randomized controlled trials, all of their data matches your experience?
Yeah. So I would say, I tell most people, no one's going to get 100% improvement. It just doesn't. No matter what company out there tells you that they're going to get 100, they don't. So, I mean, I tell the patients, look, you'll never get 100%. At least I never promised them that. But what I will tell them it is, on average, our peripheral neuropathy patients are 60 to 80% improvement, which to them, they hear you say 60 to 80% improvement and what their current pain level is, they're like, where do I sign, right? Because they're at such a high level of discomfort that even bringing it down 50% is a significant improvement for their quality of life.
And how about sleep disturbance?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously nighttime is the worst time, right, for these patients, right? Because now they're laying in bed and they're not thinking about anything other than how bad their feet are bothering them. So that's the other big thing. They'll come in and be like, I had one just last week. I did a trial. He was a guy and he said that was the first time he slept 6 nights in a row all the way through the night, and he hadn't done that in 5 years. So, I mean, he was ecstatic. And so it's a really cool thing to see these patients and follow up after the trial and see like how excited they are. And the good and the bad about the trial is then, you know, you remove it and then they really tell you that it actually probably gives up more improvement than what they told you at the initial trial visit. Because once they've had it and then you take it away, all of a sudden they're like, oh my gosh, you know, like, wait a minute. I was a lot worse than I thought I was, you know, or I was a lot better, I should say, with the trial or with the stimulation than I was without it.
Yeah. And I'm a pretty big advocate about, you know, non-pharmaceutical approaches and targeting pain. You know, to your point, after you end the trial, you know, people reach out to you and say, hey, you know, my functional improvement is gone, you know, and I'm taking more medications again. How long is it going to take you to do the perm? Are you experiencing that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're super antsy to get the perm done as soon as you get done. The problem is the world we live in insurance, it's not, hey, we're going to do the perm next week, which I like to give them typically at least 2 weeks to kind of cool off from the trial anyway with inflammation and everything. The problem a little bit is just if they start getting too far out, what I've seen from me, because I still do perms for some of the pain management docs in town. So they've done the trial. But maybe by the time they see me get worked up and we do it, say it's been 2 months, I've found now that I pretty much always have to access a level above the level they access because of scar tissue issues. And you can get in there, but you can't get the lead to fill. It's likely, I think, is because you get a little bit of bleeding in that epidural space. And just like we see clot and vein, right? After a couple of weeks, it starts going from jelly to scar tissue, essentially. So I end up now, if they're over basically 4 to 6 weeks, I'll just access a level above where I did before. Obviously, the hope or the goal is to get them in earlier than that. But then for multiple reasons, patient reasons, they're going on vacation. They don't want to be sore for a month after the permanent placement, right? They may get pushed out.
And, you know, I keep jumping over, you know, the symptomatic improvement, but what are your thoughts on the data demonstrating improvements in A1Cs and also weight loss?
Yeah, that's interesting. To what degree is it all just purely based on their now quality of life and functionality and their improvement in their daily activities and what they're doing? So they're burning more calories, they're eating less because their depression levels are, I mean, there's so many nuances to it that it's going to be, I don't know, that's kind of to the point of all these other like decreasing diabetic foot wounds and fall risks. It's like there's so many other avenues that this has turned out to kind of spider web into, or butterfly effect, I guess you should say, that I think over the next coming years, it's a really exciting time for stimulation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been really impressed by the fact that it seems durable, you know, out 2 years. So that's been really nice. Any thoughts? You know, I mean, you were pretty honest and open about, you know, kind of the risks of this procedure. You know, one of the things that I think, right, is just making sure that we actually get some blood work in advance. Anything that you check prior to going in the epidural space?
Yeah, routine. Obviously, we want to make sure they're off all their thinners and everything for designated times. But, and then since we use anesthesia and they're prone, we still need to be somewhat smart about it, right? You don't want to be putting a horrible COPD / emphysema that's a CO2 retention patient that you're going to be in there, you know, have a overweight BMI and you're going to be putting them on their belly. So you got to be smart. But that's also with your anesthesia as well. The trials are pretty quick. So from that standpoint, it's not as big of a deal. But for a perm, if you're there for an hour and you're sedating them on their belly, those are all things you got to kind of look at. I have had, I'd say over the 5 years, I've had two patients that had issues over, and they were both because of that anesthesia. And one was over sedated and ended up having like a respiratory event. It was unrelated to the stimulation. And the other one was essentially about the same. They had like a CO2 retention event during it, and they had like altered mental status for a while after. We did obviously extensive workup, MRIs, you name it. It was all done and everything was fine. No underlying infection or anything like that. But so just, you still got to be careful, right? These patients are still sick patients, ultimately have high risk for cardiovascular health. So that's really the big thing.
Okay. And, anything more, your thoughts on, you know, have you had good support from endocrinology and ADA with their recommendations on 10 kilohertz? Are they aware of it?
Yeah, you know, endocrinology here specifically, we get some. It's kind of a, I don't know how it is in every other, you know, city and state. Ours are a little, I guess I won't say like tough to crack, but we don't have, not many have like this great working relationship with endocrinology here, which is weird. You think you would, especially when they're the ones seeing primarily all these patients. But to be honest, too, that's really in the city. So, you know, all of these patients are being primarily worked up by their primary care physicians, especially out in the rural outside of the city. Endocrinology is not a huge referral source. It should be, but it's not a huge referral source to us at this time. But I think the more that we go out and we do talks, and obviously they're getting more and more literature about it in their meetings as well, about especially 10 kilohertz data, I think it's going to become more commonplace, at least for here, for us here in Oklahoma. It may be different. I don't know where you are at.
And a little bit related, any thoughts on your rural community, the farmers, on the thoughts of, hey, you know, we have AI now that is helping us to, you know, observe your data, see where you're having pain, you know, see which algorithm, or do people say, you know, I don't really like the fact that you're using AI?
No, I haven't had anybody yet, but that is shocking because in Oklahoma, you know, we're still worried that there's like, you know, robots in our vaccine. So but no, I haven't. I think they're just happy they don't have their pain significantly improved, and they'll just leave it at that and turn their head at the rest.
And are your patients, you know, if they're going to get an MRI, you know, some of our radiology colleagues want to hear about that, is, are your patients capable of controlling from their phone, or are they usually using the rep, or how do they get
patient that dependent? Just depends on how technology savvy the patient is. So we've got patients that want it on their phone. They got the app, you know, or depending on the company, they give them one and they do it all themselves. They're they're good enough to change their own programs, you know, alter from what based on what they're doing or whatever, to we have patients that, you know, you have to hold their hand through everything. So it's all over the map, to be honest with you, at least for our patient population. But that's the beauty of, you have a rep that's, like I always tell them, they're married to whichever rep is in the room now that I had, like, this is your, you know, obviously they can contact me anytime, but that you now have that to always lean on versus you do a, put a stent in somebody's leg. No one knows who the heck your stent rep at your Abbott or whoever rep is, right? So that is a definite bonus to the space.
And then I think, you know, the last thing before I let you go is just, you know, are you this guy that's tossing out scripts for opioids now?
I do zero. So I don't do any pain management. Okay. And I will tell you that Oklahoma laws really cracked down in the last couple of years. And that even goes for me doing it for uterine fibroids. Like, I write a minuscule amount compared to what I used to for fibroid outpatients. But so no, even most interventional pain docs in our state don't even do opioid. We have specific pain docs. Most of them are like family medicine or whatever that specialize in pain. And they're the ones that primarily do all the narcotic scripts. So no, I write post-op pain meds, just like I do for any procedure if they need it. But other than that, I don't do any opioid management.
And, you know, along those lines, I've heard some of our pain colleagues will state, you know, when the patient comes in, we let them know right from the beginning, you know, this is a non-pharmaceutical approach. Do you have any kind of conversation with that to let them know you're not going to give them opioids?
Yeah, if they ask. I think most of them, and I kind of have that talk to them about it as well, which I'll find that a lot of my neuropathy patients aren't on opioids, which has been a bonus. Obviously, I will still see some back pain patients every now and then, and they are inevitably on some form of opioid, so that's more of a discussion with them. But really, most of my peripheral neuropathy patients aren't on it. And they were just on your typical, you know, Lyricas or gabapentin. So, but to the question you asked, yes. And that's the same question I get all the time, even if I'm dealing with PAD patients, got rest pain and you're revasking them and all that. Like, yeah, I can write you for 7 days at a time and we'll get through here. But if we got to go out, I've got to get you involved with pain management, and that we're not going to be doing long-term opioid management.
Fantastic. And to your point, you know, your practice is focused on vascular disease and diabetic neuropathy, but you noted that you're also getting some perms from other people. Are those patients, you know, failed back or non-surgical back? And are you getting any other challenges with them?
A mixture. More back pain related, obviously coming from them, more so than specifically for peripheral neuropathy. If you talk to even most of the company reps, they will tell you that even their busy interventional pain guys don't do a lot of neuropathy. It's just not something that gets funneled to them. So that's kind of a little bit of how this is, you know, evolved into a really a good aspect of our practice, is that we do see them. And it's not even because we're trying to see them. It's just because we have their other disease processes that come with it. So that part has been an easy transition, but yeah, more back pain. And like we said, really the back pain part of it has been, since it's usually for perms, it's even a little easier for me, right? Because I'm just going to put the perm in, and then ultimately they're going to go back to their pain management doctor that they came from. So I'm just essentially there to do the procedure and then send them back. Ultimately, it just depends on their spinal surgery history and how long it's been and what all's been involved. And that can sometimes be a little bit more challenging, just being able to get in the epidural space and actually like feeling that release, you know, into the space and that stuff. So you just have to, it can take a little longer than a native back.
And maybe that's our closer discussion, but you know, you noted that a lot of neuropathy isn't really in pain practices. I think, you know, some of our colleagues are worried that, are we going to step on any toes? But it seems like whether you're OBL, ASC, private hospital, or academic, really the neuropathy patients are in your clinic.
Correct. Yeah. And I hear that across the board. We use several different companies. So, you know, I'm always talking to the reps like, hey, you know, are you seeing a lot? Are you treating a lot of peripheral neuropathy around, like, you know, the other practices? I mean, because it's here, I'm sure it's like everywhere else. There's a pain doctor on every corner. So, you know, what are they saying? And they will tell you. I think that's why ultimately these companies are also very excited about IR in the space as well, right? Because we have the skill set to be able to do this. fairly easily just because of our training and what we do and all the other different aspects of medicine. But we also, depending if you do have a vascular-based practice or you see them at all, you're going to have these patients already in your practice. So I think it's a pretty easy transition.
And for those of your friends that don't have such a great, you know, multi-specialty group with ASC and OBL, would you recommend if they're doing PAD in the OBL to do trials and then hand off the perms to someone else?
Yeah, that'll just be something they have to figure out just because they have an OBL plan, they shouldn't be able to not also have privileges and or potential ownership in an ASC either, right? So it just depends on the group and the practitioner. Is it advantageous for them to be able to go out, say, have a PSA contract with an ASC or have a ownership where they're going to get a piece? That'll just depend on, I guess, the player and what their contractual obligations are to their current group and the OBL. You know, there's a little bit more politics involved, I guess, on that end, but it depends on what makes sense to them from a time management. How busy are you? Is it worth your time to take that perm over and do it and maybe just make a physician fee on it versus getting a piece of the technical component at your own facility? That's what we see to the initial, you know, at the beginning of the conversation about how I started with pain management is because of that very same thing, right? So they're happy with doing the trial because of the low overhead in their clinic space, but it doesn't make sense for them because they're so busy from a volume standpoint to take the time to go do the perm for a $400 or $500 physician fee or whatever it is, compared to they could have already knocked out three trials and made three times the amount of money, right? So for them, it makes more sense from, there's only so many hours in the day, so what's going to make you the most sense?
Anything you want to add? Been fantastic.
I mean, anyone's more than happy, as always, to reach out if they have questions. You know, I think there's plenty of IR docs out there, obviously, as the vascular space for IR has kind of come back, I think, over the last 5 to 8 years. There's plenty of people now in the space and have the patients and are doing clinic, right? I mean, clinic's still, I think, sometimes a scary word for IR doctors, even though it shouldn't be, and putting out there and being a clinician. And I think it's just a lot easier transition and procedure than what's perceived, right? I think anything with the spine kind of freaks people out. I mean, if you're able to do a kyphoplasty and all those type of things, you're going to be fine.
Perfect. And I'm sure, like you said, we'll have to have you back for a 2024 reimbursement discussion, and maybe we'll include this again in that.
Not a problem.
Great. Thank you, Blake.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck, Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Sudley.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.
From our sponsor. Results of Nevro 10 kHz therapy may vary. Please visit www.nevro.com/manuals for product manuals with complete indications, contraindications, warnings, precautions, and potential adverse events.